Support for The World's Podcast comes from LegalZoom. With over 17 years and more than 2 million customers, LegalZoom provides helpful support, legal advice, and transparency for business owners. More information at LegalZoom.com/world.
Definitely not a slow news day today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Our big stories today span the globe, from rising tensions between India and Pakistan.
What is unprecedented is that India and Pakistan are nuclear-armed rivals, and this amounts to a major escalation of conflict.
To Vietnam, where the U.S.-North Korea summit is underway, with South Korea a skeptical bystander.
The South Korean populace probably sees that there actually hasn't been that much progress from all three sides together.
And back to Washington, where Trump's former lawyer unloads on his old boss.
He is a racist, he is a con man, and he is a cheat.
Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We have two stories about nuclear weapons today. North Korea's nuclear program is the focus of the summit just underway between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un. We'll get the view from South Korea. But we start off with India and Pakistan, where tensions between the two nuclear-armed adversaries have escalated quickly. Today, Pakistan says it shot down two Indian fighter jets. This follows Indian airstrikes against Pakistan. And that attack was retaliation for a suicide bombing that killed 40 Indian troops earlier this month. With me so far? I asked my BBC colleague Devanshur Gore how this conflict looks to both countries, starting with India.
There has been a mood of triumphalism, militaristic nationalism, great aggression in the Indian media.
What about in the Pakistani media? What are you seeing?
So on the Pakistan, it's the same story in the Pakistani media. It's a story of competing narratives in the media. So this is, apart from the military action that is taking place, it's also a war of words between the Pakistani and Indian media. So while there's aggressive nationalism in the Indian media, it's the same from the Pakistani side. And there are also major points of difference in reporting the details of what's actually happened. So while the Indian media keep reporting that the Indian fighter jets entered into Pakistani-controlled space and bombed a militant camp there, and they say that they killed up to 300 militants at the camp, the Pakistani narrative is completely different. The Pakistani media have been replaying a statement from the military spokesman there that, in fact, there was no bombing of any camp there, that the Indian jets did enter space, airspace controlled by Pakistan, but that they were actually repelled by the Pakistani Air Force, and that in a hurry they dropped their bombs in a place which led to actually no casualties or damage. Since then, the story of competing narratives between the media of two sides has continued. So this morning, reports started coming from Pakistan that the Pakistani aircraft had actually come and attacked Indian military installations in Indian-administered Kashmir. And the media reports from Pakistan said that they had, in fact, downed two Indian jets and that they had arrested two Indian pilots.
And on that story, India is saying, yes, one of our pilots is missing.
There is a man, a video of whom has been shown on Pakistani television. And the Pakistani media say that this is a missing Indian pilot. But from the Indian side, India has said that it needs to be verified whether this is, in fact, the Indian pilot who's gone missing.
As you well know, Kashmir has been disputed between India and Pakistan for decades. There's been four wars fought about it. What is unprecedented about this particular crisis?
Well, what is unprecedented is that India and Pakistan are nuclear rivals, nuclear-armed rivals, and this amounts to a major escalation of conflict. And the fact that Indian jets flew fairly deep into Pakistani-controlled territory amounts to a major escalation, because the last time such an action was carried out by the Indian Air Force against Pakistan was in 1971 when the two countries went to war. But they were not nuclear-armed neighbors then.
A lot of people are saying that Narendra Modi is using this crisis for political reasons, because there's going to be an election. Is that being discussed in the media?
Well, that is certainly a line that is being taken in the Pakistani media. And while there might be cynics in India who may, well, for their own reasons, take that position, but I think that at the moment in the Indian media, there seems to be more unity on this question. In fact, the Indian opposition have not criticized the prime minister over this. So that is certainly a line that has been taken in the aftermath of the recent developments in the Pakistani media.
Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan, he's made a televised address. What has he said?
Well, he has appealed for calm. He says that because the two countries are nuclear rivals, they cannot afford to escalate this conflict. And he has offered that talks should be held over the issue of terrorism, which has been a major question for India. And he warns against the conflict escalating. And he says that if we let this happen, then it will remain neither in my control nor in Narendra Modi's control. That's the Indian Prime Minister. And there has been no reaction to this yet from Narendra Modi. Although the Indian Foreign Minister, Sushma Swaraj, she has made a statement that India will act responsibly and with restraint.
In reading about this crisis right now, it sounds like Pakistan is really kind of tense. You know, there's no planes going except into Karachi, that the country is kind of on edge. Do you feel that India is on edge right now?
Well, there is definitely a mood of great tension in India. And there has been a lot of talk of war amongst some of the more sensationalist Indian television channels. So, yes, I would say that there is a tense situation that prevails.
Devanshu Gore is with BBC Monitoring in Delhi. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Meanwhile, the U.S.-North Korea summit got underway in Vietnam. President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un met for dinner at a luxury hotel in Hanoi.
I think that your country has tremendous economic potential, unbelievable, unlimited. And I think that you will have a tremendous future with your country, a great leader.
You can hear Trump there calling Kim a great leader. The two will meet again tomorrow, Hanoi time, to talk about the hard stuff, like whether North Korea will ever give up its nuclear program. The government of South Korea is watching all this very closely. The South Korean public, they're a little less interested. Kelly Kasulis has been reporting on this for The World. She's in Seoul. Kelly, how closely are South Koreans following this year's U.S.-North Korea summit?
There isn't exactly any survey or poll data to really have hard numbers on the general population, but I spent this past week talking to South Koreans on the street and elsewhere, and it seems like most of the ones that I've spoken with are not really closely following the summit, and they just quite frankly have better things to care about.
And are the people you spoke with are mostly younger, or did it cross generations, that kind of apathy?
The apathy, I would say, is mostly concentrated to younger people, people who are up until their 30s. The older generation has kind of experienced the aftermath of the Korean War or the Korean War itself and might be a little bit more tuned in. But I would say overall, I do get the sense that there's this kind of atmosphere of disinterest or, just a lack of excitement compared to previous summits.
What's behind that lack of excitement?
You know, it's been 8 months since President Trump has met with Kim Jong-un in Singapore. It's been quite a while since Moon Jae-in has met with Kim Jong-un as well. And I feel like the South Korean populace probably sees that there actually hasn't been that much progress from all three sides together. So far, the South Korean population is used to hearing a lot about Moon Jae-in, the South Korean president's plans to kind of move the South Korean economy forward with economic cooperation with North Korea. And just frankly speaking, none of that has happened so far, and there really haven't been any nuclear negotiations. So I think people are just kind of waiting for something new to happen.
So is Moon Jae-in making the case that economic cooperation with North Korea will improve South Korea's economy?
Absolutely. And I would say that most of his domestic policy regarding the economy is exactly that. It's certainly a critique that a lot of South Korean's constituents have of President Moon.
And what would South Koreans prefer Moon Jae-in focus on in terms of South Korea's economy?
Based on my conversations with everyone so far, it really seems like South Koreans would just rather have President Moon focus on the South Korean domestic policy and a South Korean domestic policy that is not related to North Korea. So in this case, it would be the economy, widespread youth unemployment, which is a serious issue, as well as the way that the population is aging. And so far, I would say that, you know, this is a pretty popular opinion among many age demographics. It's not that they don't want some kind of progress with North Korea on the diplomatic side, but it's that they're suffering and they're struggling in an everyday economy, and they're just not satisfied with what the president is doing so far.
It sounds like there's a lot of impatience with President Moon Jae-in's policy toward North Korea and his focus on that. Is he out of touch with what South Koreans are really concerned about?
I actually don't think that President Moon is out of touch at all. I think that he's doing the best he can to tackle the North Korea issue, and he is making some progress on the economy with some domestic policies as well. But I think that a lot of South Koreans often see North Korea in the headlines, and they have resentment towards North Korea, and they just wish that this economy would get better faster. So in a way, I don't think that he's out of touch, but I think that they think that South Korea and its issues are far more important than dealing with North Korea and the war situation.
Reporter Kelly Kasulis in Seoul. For more on why many South Koreans are skeptical about the summit, head over to theworld.org. No doubt the White House would prefer if everyone's attention remained focused today on the summit in Vietnam, but there's no ignoring that other news involving the president unfolding almost simultaneously on Capitol Hill.
I am ashamed because I know what Mr. Trump is. He is a racist. He is a con man. And he is a cheat.
That's Michael Cohen, President Trump's former lawyer and fixer, testifying today before the House Oversight Committee. As you heard there, he had some harsh words for his old boss. Some Republicans on the committee took issue with Cohen's appearance and also its timing. Here's Representative Bob Gibbs from Ohio.
You come in here and you rail on the President of the United States, Commander-in-Chief, while he's over across the Pacific Ocean trying to negotiate a deal to make this world safer. And Mr. Chairman, just having this committee at this time when the Commander-in-Chief's out of the country is just, I think, is a new president.
The World's Matthew Bell has been following the story. He's in the studio with me now. Matthew, what did we learn about the Trump-Russia investigation today?
Cohen had to be careful with the way he talked about some of this stuff because of these ongoing investigations, but he brought it up. Here's part of his opening statement.
The questions have been raised about whether I know of direct evidence that Mr. Trump or his campaign colluded with Russia. I do not. And I want to be clear, but I have my suspicions.
Was he asked to follow up on that?
Of course, he was asked to follow up on those suspicions numerous times. Again, he was careful the way he talked about it. But at one point, Cohen was asked about these details if candidate Trump knew during the 2016 campaign that there was some sort of coordination with the Russians during that campaign. Here's some of what Cohen had to say about that.
This is a matter that's currently being handled by the House Select and the Senate Select Intelligence Committees. And so I would rather not answer that specific question other than just to tell you that Mr. Trump's desire to win would have him work with anyone.
So, of course, Carol, a big question that did come up today was about the Russian hacking of Democratic Party officials' emails during that campaign season and then the publication by WikiLeaks.
Which leads us to Roger Stone, Trump's longtime friend and unofficial advisor. What did we hear about him?
Exactly. And Stone is another person close to Trump that's facing possible jail time. Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller at the Department of Justice has detailed Stone's connections to WikiLeaks. You can read about that in the indictments. WikiLeaks published those emails from DNC officials. And today, here's an exchange with the Democratic Congressman Peter Welch from Vermont, who was asking Cohen to describe a meeting that Cohen says he was sitting in Donald Trump's office. And this was a conversation that Cohen said took place, and this is new, between Trump and Roger Stone. He overheard it because Trump talked on a speakerphone.
It was a short conversation, and he said, Mr. Trump, I just want to let you know that I just got off the phone with Julian Assange, and in a couple of days, there's going to be a massive dump of emails that's going to severely hurt the Clinton campaign.
And was Mr. Trump and Mr. Stone aware of where those emails came from?
That I'm not aware of.
Did Cohen talk much about his reasons for testifying today?
He absolutely did. He talked about redemption. He says he knows he's going to jail. He's going to pay for what he's done. But he hopes that this will be the beginning of some sort of path to a new life.
Hmm. The World's Matthew Bell. Thanks, Matthew.
You're welcome.
Investigating a whale jail in Russia. You're tuned to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The movie Blackfish a few years ago put a bright, unwelcome spotlight on SeaWorld and made Americans reckon with the discomfort of putting creatures as big and wild as whales in pools for entertainment. If that seems like a problem that's been solved, then turn your attention to the Russian Far East. Reporter Charles Maines is in Moscow, and he's here to explain this. Charles, this is a story about a specific group of whales that were captured in the wild. What can you tell us about it?
Well, the story really goes back to the summer of 2018. Environmental activists out in the Far East, they discovered 11 orcas and around 90 beluga whales that they'd been captured, were being held near the city of Vladivostok, and not far from the Chinese border, in these open water pens that they dubbed a whale jail. This wasn't the first time they've seen this sort of trend. I talked to Vyacheslav Kozlov. He's from the Friends of the Ocean. This is a citizen monitoring group out in the Far East. And he says that he started observing this trend back in 2013 when 13 orcas were captured. So what Kozlov is saying here is that basically when you capture them, you essentially have to separate family members. So a lot of times that one whale will be caught in the net and suffocate and die. They don't really know the numbers that have perished. But then he goes to the issue of holding these animals in pens. These are open pens with nets in the bottom. It's fairly crowded for the orcas. The belugas also are outdoors with workers surrounding them trying to keep the water free from ice. So, you know, activists will say this is really stressful for the animals. One beluga was reported to have died this week.
The people who run this place, what do they say the whales are there for? Do they openly say we're going to sell them to somebody, or what do they say they're doing?
You know, they don't. These Russian companies have received quotas to capture whales for scientific or educational purposes. Now, there is an international ban on whale capture, but Russia is not a signatory to it. You know, the problem is these animals, although they're technically here for some research, it appears that they're really on export for China. Orcas fetch up to $6 million apiece. And, you know, just to make that point, Putin's point guy for the region, a guy named Yuri Trukhnov, who's the deputy prime minister, basically admitted as much. So Trukhnov was saying that, you know, if scientists say that we're not doing these animals as a species any harm, then why should the Americans be allowed to sell these animals to China and not Russia? Now, I have to say, Carol, that that's actually not true. The U.S. does not export orcas or beluga whales to China.
There's been international attention on this. I mean, gee, we're talking about it. What do Russians think about this? Do they see it as a big controversy?
They do, and it's been making headline news here, even on state media. We had protests in Moscow over the weekend to raise awareness, and it's interesting. This has finally gotten the attention of Vladimir Putin, the Russian president. And he set a deadline for officials to figure this out by the end of the week. Now, it may not be that simple. You've got the courts to deal with. If Putin, I suspect, really wanted to get involved, he could solve this thing tomorrow. But there's other issues. It's interesting that state media here is raising the issue of having now held these animals for over 6 months. Could they survive after being let go?
What about the environmental activist you spoke with? Is he hopeful that this will end well for the whales?
Well, he's hoping for the right decision to be made here. But, you know, it's important to point out that, you know, dealing with an issue of freeing whales is a little bit easier, you know, to get some attention, to get the public sort of rallied behind you than some of the other environmental issues that Russia faces today. You know, Vladimir Putin's record on saving an animal is quite good from time to time. His interest in, for example, trying to save the tigers in the Far East, but he has a much more spotty record when it comes to environmental policy.
Charles Maines, reporting from Moscow. Thanks a lot, Charles.
Thanks, Carol.
Liberty was the clarion call of the American Revolution, but as cynics in Great Britain pointed out at the time, the loudest voices for freedom came from men who owned slaves. Some African Americans won their liberty by fighting for the colonies, but many more took a very different path to freedom, by joining the British. Records of slaves joining the British Army are few, but historian Todd Braisted has just published an article documenting the life of one such man, a South Carolina teenager known originally as Barney. Tell us first about Barney. How old was he when he joined the British Army?
He was around 17 years old. There are some documents that we are aware of through a British officer named John Graves Simcoe. He took some prisoners from a Continental Artillery unit that had several young slaves in uniform, and he claimed them for the British, apparently Barney being one of them.
So Barney didn't necessarily join the British Army. He was forced to be in it.
He was given an opportunity that he did not relinquish. We'll put it that way. But we know enough that Barney certainly embraced the opportunity as more or less somebody who could fight for his freedom.
How unusual was it for African Americans to actually become fighting men for the British Army during the Revolutionary War?
Well, fighting is a subjective word. Unfortunately, for the British Army, there was a prohibition on blacks actually bearing arms. They couldn't enlist as regular soldiers. So Barney, his future as a fighting man was somewhat limited. By joining Simcoe's unit, the Queen's Rangers, he could, however, serve as a trumpeter. Everyone who's seen cavalry movies, you know, knows that they have a trumpeter sounding the charge and all those sorts of things. Well, that's what Barney became. He had a sword. He probably had a pistol or two. So he could fight in that capacity.
So the British promised African Americans freedom but wouldn't let them bear arms?
Correct. They served in many other capacities. The British put them into what was called the civil branches of the army, all the support branches, the commissary general's department, the wagon master general's department. There were opportunities, but you know, if you're looking for a red coat on a black soldier, it would not be a common sight.
And what do we know about Barney's military career?
Barney served in the Queen's Rangers through the end of the war. He earned the favor of his commander, Simcoe, at a battle on June 26, 1781, near Williamsburg, Virginia. And Barney, his troop, was almost surprised. Barney had the presence of mind, however, to lead the American cavalry away from the surprised Loyalist troops, giving them a chance to mount up and take action. So Simcoe commended him for that. But Barney then charged and dismounted and attacked a Continental Army lieutenant and took him prisoner. Barney then saved the life of his troop commander, Captain David Schenck, from near death in the ensuing melee. Barney himself was wounded in the action and dismounted, but not captured. All these things are quite unusual, certainly for any member, black or white, back then.
I wanted to get to the end of the war because, as we all know, the British lost. What happened to Barney at the end of the war?
Barney sort of disappears from the record book once he is in England. If it was not for Simcoe's request to the War Office, there would be no trace of him.
But interestingly, Barney's service for the British Army was rewarded financially.
Correct. As a wounded soldier, Barney was actually eligible for what was called the Chelsea Pension. So he could go and collect money for his support for the rest of his life, which was something not afforded to all British soldiers. You had to basically earn it.
Todd Braisted's article on the life of trumpeter Bernard Barney Griffiths appeared this month in the Journal of the American Revolution. Thanks a lot, Todd.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills. Riding a bike can be an easy commute or just a fun time. But for women in Saudi Arabia, riding a bike also means defying expectations.
You need to have a brave heart for the first time. You just have to go brave it and do it so everyone will get excited and follow you.
Our ongoing look at Saudi Arabia's changing culture ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Saudi Arabia has a new ambassador in Washington, D.C. She is Princess Rima Bint Bandar bin Sultan, and she's the first woman to represent the kingdom here in the U.S. The move has been hailed by some Saudi watchers as a positive step. Critics say it's just window dressing. Politics aside, the princess has been passionate about something else, women's sports in Saudi Arabia. The World's Shirin Jafari was curious about that, too. So when she was in Saudi Arabia recently, she set out to find out how one woman is pushing to normalize cycling. The story took her to the port city of Jeddah in the western part of Saudi Arabia, where she was accompanied by a government minder.
Every time I ride my bike here in Boston, I remind myself how lucky I am to be able to get on a bike and go. No fear, no shame, no consequences. I grew up in Iran, where even today, women rarely ride a bike in public. There's no specific law. It's just not done. It's similar in Saudi Arabia. But recently, the Crown Prince has been loosening some of the social restrictions on women. And now, women are getting into cycling. So what's it like for a woman to ride a bike in Saudi Arabia? I'm told there's one person who can explain. To find her, I have to wake up super early on a weekend, head to the only public bike path in Jeddah, the one that opened 2 years ago, then look for a young, petite woman on a bike. She'd be the one in the fancy helmet and bike shoes. She's not hard to spot.
Hi.
Hello.
No pressure.
My name is Dua Naim. I'm into sport. I love most kind of sports, mostly into cycling.
Naim is wearing the loose robe that all women have to wear in public, but she has cleverly customized hers. It's got a zipper, and she can tie the bottom edges into knots so they don't get caught in the wheels.
Yes, and whenever I'm off my bike, I just make it in the regular size and go around, so that's not a problem. This is a custom-made abaya.
Naim is one of a group of Saudi women who are quietly pushing the boundaries of what's acceptable for women in public. She says when she first started riding her bike a few years ago, heads turned.
People start looking, staring, some people taking pictures, videos, turning around.
Naim's father taught all of his children how to ride a bike. But when they became teenagers,
suddenly the bikes disappeared for the females.
Her brother kept his, but it was understood that Naim and her sister would have to give up theirs. But Naim got busy with school. Later, she got married, and she and her husband traveled abroad and explored different cities on bikes.
And we said, that's so nice, why can't we have this, the same experience in Jeddah? No.
Because religious conservatives forbid women to exercise in public.
Saudi Arabia has confirmed it will be sending two female athletes to the London Olympics.
When the kingdom sent its first ever female athletes to the 2012 London Games, hardliners called them prostitutes. Girls didn't even have PE classes in school until 2 years ago. No surprise then that obesity has become a serious health problem in Saudi Arabia, especially among women.
I'm not.
I went to see Yasmin Al-Tawajri, a public health expert, at her home in Riyadh.
Do you have a pug?
Yes, she has a pug. His name is Poe.
Poe. There's this character in Star Wars.
Focus. Focus.
Right now, if I am a Saudi woman, what are my options for exercising?
You would have to do it at home or join a gym. Or go to a mall and walk in the mall because it's air-conditioned. That's about it.
Al-Tawajri says most Saudi women have grown up without exercise as part of their daily lives. That includes herself.
I had no physical activity.
So when physical education finally became part of the curriculum for girls, Al-Tawajri says she had mixed feelings about it.
Actually, not just me. I think my generation of women in general have mixed feelings because we're so happy that it happened, but we're kind of sad that it happened so late and that we missed this opportunity when we were younger.
Sedentary lifestyle isn't the only culprit, she says. There's more access to fast food and there are more food delivery services.
Uber Eats is a challenge for parents who are trying to control their kids' eating behaviors. And even before that, McDonald's here would deliver to the home.
Dua Naim, the cyclist, says recently people have become more accepting of women on bikes. Maybe it's because the Crown Prince has clipped the wings of the morality police. They used to cruise the streets to make sure women are dressed modestly and follow the kingdom's strict rules. Jeddah, where Naim lives, is more liberal compared to other parts of the country. 20-year-old Abrar Arshai, who's visiting from nearby Medina, says cycling hasn't caught on in her town.
Not in Medina. I live in Medina and maybe you can see three women a month. Not so much, no.
Yeah. And then what do you think about, you know, other women riding their bikes here?
I like the idea.
Hey, you can drop the rush this way.
Naim is making use of this rare opening. She gets on her bike, adjusts the saddle, and 15 minutes later.
How was it?
It was nice. Yeah, it was kind of, because today is hot.
Her face is flushed. She's sweating. But she also looks exhilarating.
Especially with the work abaya.
so difficult.
For sports like cycling, you need to have a brave heart for the first time. You just have to go braver and do it so everyone will get excited and follow you and do the same.
And Naeem's persistence has paid off. Recently, she got a call from the Saudi Cycling Federation.
Because they want to form a Saudi cycling female team.
Naeem is getting more women involved in cycling. Today, she's with her sister, Fatima. Their bikes might have disappeared when they were kids, but now they have new ones, better, shinier ones. And they can bike together and make up for the rides they missed. For The World, Shirin Jafari, Jeddah.
Tomorrow, Shirin brings us a story about the comedy scene in Saudi Arabia. She spoke with one of the very few women comedians in the kingdom who explained some of the challenges of her job.
If you are exceptionally talented, then okay, you need to lose 10 pounds, you need to do a nose job, you need to do some Botox, you need to do even in the Arab media.
That's tomorrow. For more stories and photos from our series, A Troubled Kingdom, head to theworld.org. Saudi Arabia has some 5 million Twitter users. Rumors move like lightning when a post goes viral. The Saudi government, of course, has official Twitter accounts, but it also has backup from an army of unofficial accounts. Automated bots and real live Twitter trolls harass people when they disagree with the Saudi government. Mark Owen Jones is a British academic who was raised in the Middle East, and he's made a study of Saudi Arabia's propaganda on Twitter.
The problem of bots spreading Saudi propaganda is hugely widespread, but it changes. So every now and then we'll see tens of thousands of bots tweeting every day pro-Saudi propaganda. And then maybe after several months, Twitter will have a cull and reduce those numbers. And then we see a decline in activity, and then we see them coming back.
What kind of messages do the bots and phony accounts put out?
So the bots almost exclusively put out messages that reflect Saudi foreign policy, depending on a specific event. So, for example, during the Jamal Khashoggi affair, bots and these influencers would be essentially putting out exactly the same story that the Saudi media was putting out. So this would be like Jamal Khashoggi wasn't killed by us initially. So it essentially reflects that.
So these are troll armies, and you're monitoring Twitter. And where do you see these messages? What kind of Twitter accounts do you see them on?
Well, it depends. I mean, there's a difference between bots and trolls. Bots tend to just reproduce propaganda. Trolls tend to attack people directly. They tend to be easy to spot. And the trolls, they have the Saudi flag in the name. They might have MBS, Mohammed bin Salman. And some of these will be real people, for sure. But some of them are not.
What are some of the other hacked accounts that you've noticed tweeting pro-Saudi messages?
One of them was a well-known weatherman from the US, Dave Schwartz, who worked on the Weather Channel. And his account was hacked, I believe, a year ago, although he passed away 2 years ago. Mm. And he even had an obituary in the New York Times. And for a time, his account, which was verified and still remains verified, was taken over by someone who was tweeting pro-Saudi propaganda. They've since stopped, although one retweet remains in his timeline. Twitter still have not unverified his account, which I find disturbing.
Explain for us, what does it mean to have a verified account?
You apply for this process. It's been suspended now, but over the past few years, what you do, you would go to Twitter with your passport details and your information. And if they deemed that you were a real person and that your account was of public interest, they would give you this blue tick next to your name, which means verification. Twitter say that it's not a sign of endorsement or recognition, but actually it functions as one. People will see verified accounts as being more credible, more trustworthy, and more secure than regular accounts.
Now, in the case of the weatherman, Dave Schwartz, he was no longer alive. So was his Twitter account, did it still have his name as the Twitter name, or had it been renamed but still had his Twitter handle?
It still had his Twitter handle. So even now, today, it still reads TWC Dave Schwartz. The name was changed to an Arabic name of a region in Saudi Arabia, but his handle still remains the same, partly because if you change the handle, you risk losing the verification status.
But how come Twitter hasn't taken the account down?
Well, I mean, this is an important question because there were several accounts that I found that were verified that had been compromised by someone or something tweeting pro-Saudi propaganda, and they had the verification status removed. That was Shayna Steiner, who was a business analyst, and two other accounts. David has not, and there's probably three explanations. Either Twitter don't know, which is unlikely because they've obviously removed the verification from other accounts. They don't care, which is possible, but I don't see why they'd remove verification from one account and not the other. Or they can't, which is worrying, because if they can't, then it would imply that there is some sort of compromise of the integrity of their security.
Why would it benefit Saudi Arabia, the trolls or the bots, to take over Dave's Twitter account? It's going to his followers who are probably not interested in Saudi Arabia. So what's the point?
Well, there's a number of explanations. It could be that tweeting from a verified account impacts Twitter's algorithm so that any information from that account would be privileged and more likely to trend. The second reason might be that verified Twitter accounts are important social currency in Saudi Arabia, and there is a market for them. So someone with a lot of money or someone who sees himself as influential wanted to purchase a verified account so that they looked like they had the social capital that they desired.
Do you have a verified account?
No, I do not. Twitter have refused me that several times, actually.
Mark Owen Jones teaches Middle East Studies and Digital Humanities at Hamid bin Khalifa University in Doha. Thanks a lot, Mark.
Thanks, Carol.
We asked Twitter for a response, and a spokesperson emailed us, "We don't comment on individual accounts for privacy and security reasons." The statement continued, "In 2018 alone, we introduced more than 70 changes to achieve a healthier, safer Twitter." And Twitter says, "We are committed to doing this work transparently and openly in pursuit of our singular focus of improved conversational health." It's been a long wait for voters in Nigeria to find out who won the presidential election there. First, the vote itself was postponed just hours before people started casting their ballots. Then it was rescheduled for a week later, and many worried that the delay would lead to low voter turnout. But over the weekend, Nigerians finally voted and then waited several days to hear the results. Today, election officials in Nigeria finally announced the outcome.
Muhammadu Buhari of the All Progressives Congress, having satisfied the requirements of the law and scored the highest number of votes, is hereby declared winner and is returned elected. Thank you.
That means a second term in office for Nigeria's incumbent president, Muhammadu Buhari. His supporters celebrated Buhari's victory on the streets of the capital, Abuja. Buhari reportedly won 56% of the votes against 41% for his main rival. Later, the president himself thanked Nigerians for keeping him in office.
I thank the millions of Nigerians who voted to re-elect me as your president for the next 4 years. I'm deeply humbled and profoundly grateful to you.
Buhari says that he's deeply humbled and profoundly grateful. He also claimed the vote was peaceful and orderly, and he blamed troublemakers for the violence that marred Nigeria's election campaign. Observers reported that more than 40 people were killed during the vote on Saturday and its aftermath. And there are other big question marks hanging over his election, like fraud allegations. In fact, Buhari's main rival, opposition leader Atiku Abubakar, is planning to challenge the results. Kola Olobondian is a spokesman for the opposition PDP party.
It is a sad commentary on the electoral system of our nation. As I can say, I think in the history of this country, this will appear to be the worst election. And for us in the People's Democratic Party, the result is totally unacceptable.
A spokesman for Nigeria's opposition party previewing a legal challenge to the country's recent presidential election. You're tuned to The World. Sweets are a central part of life for the couple we're about to meet. They are bakers from Iraq. They got married there just before the U.S.-led invasion and the fall of Saddam Hussein. Later, they witnessed horrific violence in Baghdad, and eventually they decided to flee and seek asylum here in the U.S. Today, they run their own bakery in Spring Valley, California, near San Diego, which is where reporter Margot Wall went to meet them.
Hi, welcome.
Hello.
So what do you like to try today? This one?
That's Manar Najjar. She and her husband, Nael, own this bakery situated in a strip mall, flanked by a boxing gym and a cell phone repair shop. Inside the bakery, glass windows are all that stand between customers and rows of Middle Eastern delicacies.
This is regular baklava with pistachio, and I have walnut. American like it. This one, chocolate baklava.
Oh my God, it's so good.
It's something like crazy delicious.
$6. The store had a rocky start, but 1.5 years in, business is booming. Nael will bake throughout the day to fulfill orders, while Manar will attend to the customers.
Have a nice day.
Before the customers make it out the door, they ask for the hours of the shop.
9 o'clock morning until 11.
That's 11 at night. Alhamdani is open 7 days a week, 14 hours a day, even on Christmas, a holiday they celebrate. The Najjars are Christian, a big reason why they are in the States now. In Iraq, their home country, they faced persecution at the hands of Islamic State group. The shop is busy, and I want to ask Manar and Nael about their life in Iraq.
Okay, honey.
So they take me back to their two-bedroom apartment. And Nael and Manar tell me how they first met.
So he lives in Baghdad, and I live in Mosul. And his cousin, he married with my sister.
They met at the wedding. At the time, Nael wasn't in a rush to get married. His mother, on the other hand...
My mother, you need marriage because I am 27. In Iraq, marriage at 20, maybe 21. Yeah.
So his mom pressured him to get married, and Nael remembered Manar from the wedding and thinks she might make a good match. The rest happens pretty quickly.
He come in my home, and we talk together. So then I see him. I love him. He's a good man. So after that, I told him yes.
Yeah.
After one meeting and a verbal consent, it's customary for the man's whole family to visit the woman's home. And Nael had a lot of family.
Yeah, 12. They come in 12 people.
8
my
brother,
home.
4 sister.
Yeah.
Nael worked at a bakery, and he brought a bunch of baklava in boxes, which they call packets.
So he bring it like 10 packet?
Not 10, 25 different kind, like walnut, like almond, pistachios, cashews.
And all of the boxes said the same thing on them.
All package is Manar is my name.
So romantic. Manar's father was very impressed, but Manar was a little wary.
I asked him, why is every box is Manar, my name?
Yeah.
So they told me, oh, your name is Manar. He work in store, his name Manar.
Manar is his.
Yeah, Manar yeah. Sweets.
Okay, so just a coincidence, but nonetheless, the family approved of the marriage. 2 months later...
We married.
Yeah, just 2 months.
2 months.
Yeah, finished.
The two build a life together in Baghdad. Even with an increased presence of IS militants in the city, the family felt relatively safe. They had two children, and they went to a local church, Our Lady of Salvation.
Sayyidina Najat Church?
It's at this church that the gravity of the threat of IS for Christians becomes very real. In 2010, during evening mass, IS members infiltrate the church with rifles and suicide vests.
Many terrorists coming to the church and close the door. I'm lying on the floor, and after that, every now and then, bombs, gunshots.
Terrified survivors described how the gunmen stormed into the church on Sunday evening as worshippers were praying and reading the Bible. The Christians were beaten.
Manar and Nael weren't at church that night, but a sister and cousin of Nael were. The sister survived. The cousin did not. Around the same time, Nael's brother was kidnapped for ransom.
$30,000, and he's taken my brother.
Manar and Nael were scared, but they didn't want to leave their home, their community, their jobs. However, a death threat slipped under the door, convinced the family to leave.
So after that, we make passport and we go direct to my dad in Mosul, and then we go to Turkey.
By now, most of their extended family had fled. They found new homes in different countries. The Najjars came to the U.S., to California. Nael found work nearby their apartment at a bakery, but he really wanted to be running his own bakery.
It was a dream, my husband's dream.
So they saved what little money they had left after rent and got a small loan from the International Rescue Committee. It was enough to pay the first few months of rent for a premises that used to be a barbershop. They called the bakery Alhamdani, after the town in Iraq where they got married.
Happy, oh my goodness.
was very excited to open.
Yeah, but the first 6 months, 8 months, very, very problem.
There's no oven, no industrial sink, no hood, nothing to bake with. Nael got permission from the bakery he was working at to make his recipes after hours. And then he would transport his sweets to the store where Menar would sell them. And they didn't have many customers at first.
Like every day, if it's coming one or two, and they buy like one piece or two pieces.
They barely made rent and bills. Around the 8 month mark, something starts to change.
The people start coming. Your sweet is really good. We need orders. And order and order.
Until they finally break even and start making enough money to buy a hood, an oven, a sink, a delivery car.
Yeah, one by one, now everything is ready.
It's like, back at the shop, Nael is building Menar an office where she can do bookkeeping. He's brought back some polished wood flooring from the hardware store.
Oh, this is what you got today?
Office, yeah.
Ooh, that's going to be nice.
Spirits are high, but it's going to be another 14-hour workday for Menar and Nael.
Oh, it's hard, but, you know, it's something excited to do because you make it something people like it.
What does this store mean to you and your husband?
It's my future. And my child's future.
Menar Najjar speaking there with reporter Margot Wall and our partners at the BBC. Menar and her husband, Nael, fled Iraq to seek asylum here in the U.S. They now run their own bakery near San Diego. And that's our show today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Carol Hills. Back with you tomorrow.